Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live.
And what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW, San Francisco, Bay Area.
Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Tonight, we're talking with law professor, writer, and mother of two, Laura Bazelon, about her new book, Ambitious Like a Mother, which explores how women prioritizing their careers can benefit mothers, kids, and society at large. And later in the hour, we'll hear my co-host Grace Wan's interview with Jay Dondi of the San Francisco Briona Society about that organization's new vision for the Republican Party in San Francisco. But first, let's talk redistricting. The San Francisco Chronicle has called it a disaster, while Mission Local described it as a fiasco, and it's San Francisco's attempt to redraw the 11 supervisor district boundaries to reflect new census data. Now, the process happens every 10 years, but usually without fanfare. Under the city charter, a 9-member task force is responsible for drawing the map with input from the public. Those members were named last July and started the process in September. What's at stake now is the voting power for communities across the city for the next decade. But this year's process in San Francisco has been full of drama, marked by protests, outbursts at public meetings, and a walkout by four of the task force members. And to top it off, the task force failed to meet the deadline set for it to adopt the newly drawn map, which was supposed to happen by April 15th. A few days ago. So joining us to make sense of it all is Joe Eskenazi, the managing editor and columnist for Mission Local, who has been following and reporting on San Francisco's redistricting drama from the very beginning. Joe Eskenazi, welcome back to State of the Bay.
Thank you for having me on your show.
So, Joe, before we dive into the drama around the task force, can you just give us some background first on what happened with San Francisco's population over the last decade, since the job of the task force is to redraw the map to reflect those population changes?
Well, it's grown, and it's grown by a good clip, and making things difficult for even an honest and competent body would be that it grew unevenly. It did not all grow the same in every district. San Francisco's new building and much of its population growth is spurred from District 6, the Tenderloin Soma, and District 10, which is Bayview, Hunters Point, Potrero, etc. So that makes things difficult. You have to move around the lines if some of the districts are bigger than others.
So in a way, isn't this attributable to the sort of unequal housing growth that we've seen in the city and that some districts haven't done their fair share to generate new housing?
I mean, certainly that is one of the reasons that this is more difficult. And even if it is a big reason, I tend to think that this could have been done in a way that avoided much, if not all, of the consternation and bad feelings and accusations of bad faith behavior, even taking that into account. So I think that focusing on that and that solely is misguided, if not monomaniacal.
That makes sense, although it might at least shed some light on how housing growth has occurred in the city over the last decade. But I wanted to just get to the mission of the task force here, which is to shift some voters to different districts in order to keep the districts roughly equal in size. And so for those of our listeners who don't follow San Francisco politics that closely, can you describe why a process that seems somewhat dry on its surface could actually have a really significant political impact?
Well, I mean, after World War I, fairly random lines were drawn dividing up the Middle East, and we could see how well that went. So, like, drawing lines on a map can have tremendous repercussions in everyday life, less so in cities. I mean, this is not quite on the same par, but, you know, who lives where has been a product of history and then of development, as you mentioned, and also, you know, where people were actually allowed to live. And certainly you need to take into account which kinds of communities are where, and arbitrary or even, you know, intentional line drawing can dilute the power of a community. If you have, for example, a large Black community and you choose to split them among multiple districts, then you have kept them from being able to more reasonably elect a Black representative or whomever, you know, Black voters would choose to represent them. So that's the trick of it. Redistricting is hard, even when you approach it in an honest and straightforward way. There's almost no way to do it that will make everyone happy. It takes great skill and a will to do that.
Well, hopefully this doesn't result in Middle Eastern levels of violence, but I appreciate the analogy and the import of drawing boundaries and how challenging that can be. And let's talk about some of the politically sensitive challenges here. I mean, you've written that things turned out so disastrously in part due to the task force incompetence. So can you just describe what you meant by that?
Well, among other things, members of the task force were hoping to get draft maps before voters, late last year, October, November. And the leadership of the body nixed that. The rationale was that this would be premature because public input was required. Well, public input was sought, and public input was not really reflected in the maps that were produced. And as a result, you've had this horrible hurry up and wait process where there's meaningful changes being made at 3 a.m. in these deadline meetings, which is just the worst thing you could possibly do. It's anyone's high school or college projects. You know, you're not supposed to wait and be doing significant things at 3 a.m. That ought to be when you're tying everything up with a bow. So even if there weren't allegations of undue influence and duress, that would have been a bad way to run the meeting. The meetings themselves are not efficiently run. Yes, there is interminable public comment, but this is maybe the one thing that you really need public comment on. This isn't public comment on some kind of, a resolution about how everyone should brush their teeth 3 times a day. This is serious stuff that sets the districts for the next 10 years. So this is where you actually need to and are actually required by the rules of this to seek and listen to public comment. The way they've set it up is that comment comes before they take action. So you're taking action at like 3 or 4 a.m, which is just not a great way to do things. Plus, the votes have been haphazard and there have been weird changes. And sometimes votes have been taken and then the results have been rescinded at like 3 or 4 a.m. when everyone's asleep. So it's not been a joyful process.
Yeah, well, although some college students might say that actually is a pretty good way to get work done, although I agree with you, it's not recommended for public processes. But in terms of why they were so late, is that because of their incompetence? Did they have the authority to get it done earlier? Was there political interference? What are your explanations for why they couldn't get the job done at the initial stage on time?
This is something that's yet to be determined. If it's simply a matter of not handling it correctly, that's just unfortunate. If it's a matter of hoping to push things through in the last minute with the public's minimal input and interaction, then that's a possibility as well. It depends on the reporting and what we can pull out about people's motives and just where influence is coming from and how direct.
All right, we're going to be relying on reporters like you then to get to the bottom of this. But in the meantime, can you tell us about some of the objections that were raised when the task force did finally come out with their proposed map?
Yes. The proposed map controversially splits Potrero Hill off from District 10 and puts it into District 9. So that's going out of Bayview Hunters Point and into Mission Portola area. And then the Portola, in fact, goes into District 10. So this keeps the level of black voters at about the same, puts a lot of wealthy white people into Latino stronghold of District 9, and creates a majority Asian district in District 10. District 5 has been vivisected. Lots of voters are sucked off into other districts. And that's San Francisco's most liberal district, which now absorbs the Tenderloin, which nobody seemed to want in either District 5 or District 6, where the Tenderloin formerly and for the moment presently resides. Those are some of the biggest objections people have. This is being objected to mostly by LGBTQ groups who feel that they are being split among multiple directions, by black voters from the Southeast and some Latino voters in District 9.
And Joe Eskenazi, you mentioned in one of your recent articles that the map as it currently stands isn't just moderate friendly, it's a moderate fever dream. So given everything you've talked about how these districts have been chopped up and redistributed, why did you come to that conclusion and how did it get that way?
I mean, at this point, we can't responsibly say how these maps are produced, but it's worth noting that if you were to produce a map that had this desired outcome, this is exactly what you would get, right? So in the end, it may be a difference without a distinction. I've read the articles about the quote-unquote progressive voter index, but that's not how, and that's a good tool, but like that's not the only tool, and it's not the way to look at how people elect representatives. Candidates do matter. Also, when you look at the age of voters, when you look at the race of voters, when you look at the income level of voters, when you look at people being renters versus homeowners, that's what's a truer determinant, I believe, of whether a district is going to go quote unquote progressive or quote unquote moderate. And this is the, you know, this is the district map that I think, you know, would be favored by moderates. It creates a majority, if not a supermajority, of moderate friendly districts.
And the Elections Commission at one point considered removing three members of the task force. So can you tell us about that and what happened there?
Well, it seems to be a Hail Mary by concerned progressives who seriously overplayed their hand. It was uncalled for. It was uncouth. And on top of just being a bad move, it was also a bad political move. It gave people who would be thrilled with this map cover to start comparing their opponents to Donald Trump, which is, you know, the ultimate insult in San Francisco, and to look like they were defending democracy when, in fact, the process had seriously gone off the rails. This was just not the solution, and it was just a bad idea and a bad political move.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in further drama, four of the task force members ended up walking out of the weekend meeting of the task force. One of the task force members said of the map, and this is a quote, "It looks like a KKK member's dog ate this map and threw it back up, and that's what we got." So, Joe Eskenazi, can you explain what led to that?
Yes. There was a vote in the wee hours that would have split Potrero out of District 10 and swapped it with Portola, the Portola. And this vote failed 5-4. At this point, the chair of the body, Reverend Arnold Townsend, called for a recess. According to task force member Michelle Pierce, her colleague, Vice Chair Ditka Reiner, received a phone call as she left the room and then came back shortly thereafter during the recess and said she was confused and needed to change her vote. And this confused the people that were sitting next to her, because what was being voted on was explicitly explained at the behest of the clerk. It was made very clear. And then afterwards, Ms. Reiner explained why she couldn't do this to everybody there and apologized to one of the task force members who had been pushing for this. So for her to claim she was confused kind of strains credulity. And then this controversial move was approved 5-4 after the flip-flop. And at that point, four task force members got up and walked out of the proceedings. And three of them took the highly unusual step of calling in to public comment and with varying degrees of profanity, excoriating their colleagues.
So let's talk about how this is affecting the Board of Supervisors, because they are getting in their own fights. And I saw on Twitter, Supervisor Matt Haney and Supervisor Hillary Ronan were tangling. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why those particular supervisors got involved here?
Well, it all depends on how you see this process coming down. If you say that this is just the way that the process works and you're not getting your desired outcome and you need to take your medicine, then you can say that, or you can kind of take the middle, sit on the fence position of saying, I don't like the way things are going and I don't support it, but this is democracy. Or you can take the third position, which say that there are plausible accusations from people who are in the room of undue influence and of improper weaponization of this process in order to make short-term political points and to fool around with individual people who are not liked by the occupant of City Hall Room 200. And there are plausible accusations as such that cannot be just waved away as crazy talk.
Mm-hmm. And what about the accusations that members of the task force were subject to political pressure? You wrote last week that multiple activists, I'm quoting here, and one member of the redistricting task force have said that task force chair Reverend Arnold Townsend confided in them that he had been under intense pressure from outside forces to vote in favor of the present controversial district map, unquote. So what's going on there?
Well, Reverend Townsend, who has not answered the calls of our reporter, Will Jarrett, who did the lion's share of the work on that story, along with Lydia Chavez, his colleagues say he talked about this. And his colleague, Raynell Cooper, who sits on this body, said that he was told by Chair Townsend that he was under intense pressure to vote a certain way on that Potrero Hill map because of his longtime association and friendship and support from Mayor London Breed. And in writing, he texted another activist that he had a, quote, commitment to vote that way. And he also said, I have no choice when it came to that situation. So that's confusing. because just before the walkout, Task Force member Pierce accused him of a map that was harmful to black voters and that was tantamount to ethnic suicide. And Chair Townsend said, "I tend to agree with you," which is an odd thing to say about the map you've just approved. Mm-hmm. And then he flip-flopped and voted against it after that. So his behavior has been very hard to square. Very hard to square.
All right. Well, Joe, we're going to need you again. A lot of reporting assignments here. I know you're on this at Mission Local, but we're going to need you to get to the bottom of all this. But definitely a lot of intrigue and drama here. And so you talked about some of the chaos and turmoil leading up to that meeting last Wednesday when the task force was supposed to approve the final map, but instead rejected it in a 5-4 vote. So how did that go down?
There were rumblings that this would happen, and it did come to pass. What happens next is not certain. You know, this is not one of those things where you're driving 56 miles an hour instead of 55. There are very clear stipulations in the city charter that you have to have this done in a certain time. And what's more, we've got an election in June, and everybody who's running in the district elections needs to declare a month prior because they have had to live in their districts for 30 days. So we need to know what those districts are. You know, if Matt Haney wins the assembly race tomorrow, his successor has to be someone appointed that lives in District 6. But what is District 6? So what could happen is the process could be ripped away from the task force and put in the hands of Superior Court, which is what state law says needs to happen. And a judge could draw the lines or could appoint a special master to draw the lines. But because everything's moving, or at least supposed to move, relatively quickly, it may not make sense to file a lawsuit, which a private individual could do as well, because they won't get satisfaction before this is all solved. But certainly the city has just opened itself up to legal liability and payouts. And on top of everything, it's just a real black eye for the credibility of San Francisco, which cannot do remedial government, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, you're right on top of the story. We really appreciate it, you explaining it to our listeners, although there's obviously much more to be explained here. But I just want to thank you for joining us. It's Joe Eskenazi, managing editor and columnist for Mission Local. Thanks so much, Joe.
Thank you. And certainly there's more to come.
All right. Well, look forward to having you back on to get to the bottom of this saga as it plays out. Coming up next on State of the Bay, I'll sit down with Laura Bazelon, author of the new book, Ambitious Like a Mother, to hear about the challenges facing working mothers and her quest to bust the myth that having an ambitious working mother is bad for children. That's right after the break. Stay with us.
And I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition, and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping, with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5. What a way to make.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Laura Bazelon starts her new book, Ambitious Like a Mother, Why Prioritizing Your Career is Good for Your Kids, with a piece of advice from her own mother, who worked as a doctor throughout Laura's childhood. She said, never be at the financial mercy of anyone else. And that's a fitting start to a book that celebrates the opportunities for women to pursue careers, while lamenting how they still face so many obstacles, from entrenched gender bias in the workplace to unequal sharing of domestic labor at home. Laura draws heavily from her own experience, but she also interviews dozens of women from different races, classes, and sexual orientations who have struggled to make motherhood and a career work. By telling these stories, Laura hopes to encourage women to embrace their ambition and the imbalance that comes along with being a working mother. She shows by example and with statistics that having a career is not necessarily antithetical to being a good parent. In fact, she argues prioritizing work can be good for kids. Laura Bazelon is a writer, teacher, and advocate for racial and social justice. She's a professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law, where she directs the criminal and racial justice clinical programs, and she's a mother of two. Laura Bazelon, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're going to open up the phone lines early to hear from you, our listeners. If you're a working mother, do you think having a career has been good for your kids? We'd also love to hear from the children or spouses of working mothers. Give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us a message on Twitter at State of Bay, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So, Laura, thanks again for joining us. And congratulations on your book, which I understand comes out tomorrow. So that's a big, big deal. And pleased that you can join us on the eve of this release. But I wanted to start by asking if you can give us a little background on your story as a working mother and how it motivated you to write this book.
Sure. I was inspired by my own mother, who went to medical school in the 1960s when very few women were doing that, and excelled and graduated first in her class and became a full-time working physician while raising four children. I have three siblings. And my parents, both of them, really drilled into us that it was important to have your own work and something that was important to you, that you loved, but also to be financially independent in case you needed to basically make your own way in the world. And I took that advice to heart. At the same time, I think, like so many women, I really struggled once I became a mother with feeling guilty a lot of the time that my work was taking away from my parenting. And I wanted to write this book as a source of refuge and reassurance for so many mothers who I think feel the same way.
And despite settling on your career goals early on and realizing in your own mind how fulfilling your career was, you went through, as you talk in the book, about periods where you questioned your ability as a mother. And like perhaps many women, you had this idea in your head of a selfless mother who's a primary caregiver and subordinates her own desires to her children's needs. And I was struck by how you introduced this concept, describing a mother from your childhood who all throughout your childhood you thought was a real life version of this perfect mother. But it turned out when you followed up with her later in writing this book that it wasn't quite what you thought. So can you tell us a little bit of that story of Gretchen, this mother?
Sure. When I was growing up, my best friend was a little girl named Tamara. And I just not only adored her, but adored her whole family. And in particular, her mother, who was very beautiful and seemed like the perfect stay-at-home mother. She was excellent at sewing and cooking and desserts and was always there to pick Tamara up and her sister. She just seemed like this icon of domesticity. And then when I was writing this book, I thought, I'm just going to type her name into Google and see what I get. And I almost fell out of my chair because, as it turned out, she was a professor of education at UMass Amherst. And the whole time that I had been friends with Tamara, and now given I was very little, I was 5, 6, 7, Gretchen had been studying to get her PhD. And then she went on the job market and she took a tenure track job, which ended up really resulting in the dissolution of the marriage and her moving away and having this very high powered career. So it seemed deeply ironic, but also really fitting that the person who I had held up as this icon of domesticity actually had all of these other dreams and ambitions.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the heart of your book is really a focus, it seems to me, on why prioritizing your career can be good for kids and why society unfairly stigmatizes mothers in particular who do so. And you cite research showing that kids of working mothers who are career focused weren't harmed. And in fact, in some ways, it might be good for them to have that example. So can you talk a bit about what you found in terms of the research on this question?
Yes, there was a comprehensive study done by a Harvard professor that crunched the data across, I think, 100,000 recipients and found that overall, the daughters of working mothers tended to live happier lives, make more money, be more independent, and that the sons of working mothers tended to be more balanced when it came to divvying up the tasks on the work front. And so overall, rather than suggesting that children of working mothers are harmed and neglected, it really showed that what they learned was a sense of resilience and possibility for themselves. And I found that immensely reassuring.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's unfortunately counterintuitive to many people who seem to, you know, assume the opposite. Do you have any sense as to why that's the case? Why is this? Why does this have to be a myth-busting study?
I think the problem is that for so long, we've held women to a really impossible standard, starting in the 18th century with this cult of domesticity and the idea that a mother's role was to be at home and tend to the hearth and tend to the children. And leading up even to the present day, this idea that, okay, if you have a career, it really needs to be secondary to that ultimate responsibility. And that if you're not sort of present at home and for your children in every sense of the word, you're somehow falling short, which doesn't really bear out in the data and also is not a standard to which we hold fathers. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's healthy. I also don't think that what we're selling mothers on social media, so many celebrities, these incredibly wealthy, privileged people saying, I'm a hands-on mom. I don't have any domestic help. I would quit this movie job immediately if my child wanted me to. It just sets up this expectation that no reasonable woman could ever meet. And then I honestly don't think is grounded in reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you talk about how this is in the United States. I know this wasn't exactly the scope of your book, but at the same time, it seems like this idea is really cross-cultural. But I'm wondering if, first of all, if you would agree with that. And secondly, if there are societies either present day outside of the U.S. or throughout maybe in history that haven't been subject to this myth that it's bad in some way for women to have a life outside of the home.
Well, I do think that there are other cultures, other industrialized nations that do a much better job of making women feel supported in the workplace. Most industrialized nations, they subsidize childcare. They give women paid postpartum leave, a year, 18 months. I mean, it makes an enormous difference. In the United States, most women have to take leave without pay. They have to search desperately for childcare and overpay for it if they're not fortunate enough to have family members nearby. And by refusing to support working mothers in that way, society is sending them a very strong signal. And so, unfortunately, we are very backward when it comes to telling working mothers that not only is their work important, but their sanity and their mental health is important. And we should be funding and really trying every way that we can to make sure that their lives are sane and humane.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the impacts really are quite unequal. You cited a 2020 study that a woman's unpaid domestic labor in the home exceeds a man's by 2 hours a day. So what do you think it's going to take to change that dynamic?
I'm somewhat optimistic about the generations that are coming up, the millennials and the Gen Z folks who I interviewed. You know, they really came to it, I think, generally speaking, with a different understanding and a different sense of what was fair. I think as disappointing as it is that Congress has not acted to give working mothers some of the supports that you and I have been talking about, I'm hopeful that on a state level, some legislators will do that. But more importantly, I think we're at this inflection point for working mothers because coming out of the pandemic, they've developed this track record of tremendous productivity with flexibility. They've shown that they can do their jobs as well, if not better, under far more flexible conditions. And there's a labor scarcity that they can take advantage of to bargain for better conditions for themselves and for their children.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was also interested in terms of this dynamic in your book. You talked about your interviews and discussions with same-sex couples, because, you know, most of what we've been talking about is heterosexual couples. But what did you find in terms of differences with same-sex couples in terms of how they're negotiating this? Because, you know, the obvious gender dynamics are not going to be able to be at play here.
I found that on the whole, both anecdotally and in my research, that same-sex couples were much more successful in navigating what is admittedly extremely difficult questions about who's going to do what on the domestic front and whose career at any given point is going to take priority. It seemed like when you took away these sort of ingrained gender roles, that the people in the relationship were able to come up with more equitable solutions. I say that overall as a generalization, but that is what I found.
All right. Well, I have a comment here from Jennifer in San Francisco, who writes, I have been the primary wage earner in my family since I got married in 1999. Despite my husband having several spells of unemployment, he's never taken primary responsibility for the kids. I'm the one who makes the doctor's appointments, organizes the schedules, helps him with homework. I've spoken with my husband multiple times about my frustration. It might result in some small changes, but things always seem to slide back to how they were. I'm not alone. Most of my female friends with kids are also the primary caregiver, even if they have demanding careers. And Laura, I know from your book that this is a common story that you heard from the women you interviewed. What's your response to a woman who talks about having this dynamic in their marriage?
Well, I want to say I understand with my full heart. And part of the issue, too, is that I think our culture is designed to call the mother first. When my kids are sick and need to go home from school, or when the doctor calls, or the dentist, or the name your sports team activity, they always call the mother. it's sort of like we're on speed dial and the father isn't, even though when I fill out the forms, and it's always me filling out the forms, I put both of our contact information. We are so ingrained as a society to think this is the mother's responsibility. She's the one who can leave to go get the sick kid. She's the one who's going to make all the appointments, that it's very hard to push back against that structure. It's very hard to say, you know what, the next time you need to call her dad, the next time we need to think about this differently. It's a structural reset. And I think it's very hard when you're in the role as the person who's the go-to to push back against that, in part because I think there's something comforting about knowing that you're the one, that you're the one in control, that you're the one that people turn to. And so in a strange way, as frustrating as it can be that mothers are the default, there's also a real sense of, well, I'm the most capable one. And I think until we can get to the point where we push back against that, things probably are not going to change that much.
Yeah, you talked about how a lot of women just simply don't trust their husbands to do this well. And that's just a dynamic that they have to overcome, although you do recommend that we sort of force men to have to do this and they'll get better with practice. Is that a fair assessment?
That's totally fair. And what that means is it's going to look pretty messy for a while. And a lot of people don't want to wade through that uncomfortable period. But I think if you're willing to do that and come to the other side, it'll be more equitable.
All right. So if mothers are willing to risk some incompetence from fathers, then that's the that sounds like the preferred approach here. So if you're just tuning in, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind. And tonight I'm talking with Laura Bazelon, author of the new book, Ambitious Like a Mother, Why Prioritizing Your Career is Good for Your Kids. And the book hits the stands, the virtual stands too, tomorrow. So we're pleased to have her on for this. And if you're a working mother, how do you think your career has impacted your kids? We'd also love to hear from children of working moms. Were you proud and inspired, or did you crave more time and attention from your working mom? Give us a call to share your experience. You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Or you can find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. And I have an email in from a listener, Mira, who says, please ask your guest to discuss the living technological extensions, wet nurses, nannies, workers, servants, elder siblings, etc., required for a professional class to exist, male or female. There are class, age, and gender issues involved in this issue. So Mira was hoping, Laura, that you could discuss that.
100% there are. And it is absolutely true that, especially for women in white collar professions, a lot of what maybe makes the train run on time is being able to pay people to help you at home, to take care of your kids. And certainly when I was climbing the ladder to ultimately get tenure, I at times had jobs that basically paid for my childcare and nothing else. I was very fortunate at that time to be married to someone who made enough money that was not an issue. But of course, it's a deal breaker if you're not in that fortunate situation. I think a lot of the mothers that I interviewed who had pink collar and blue collar jobs, they struggle. Sometimes they have a stay-at-home partner. Sometimes they have family nearby who are able to watch the children. But it is certainly true that, in part because, again, the state and federal government refused to step up and support and subsidize some of these expenses, women are really left to fend for themselves. And as is always the case, wealthy mothers are going to be able to buy their way out of problems that middle-class and poor mothers are not going to be able to.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you, Mira, for posing that question. And let's go to the phone lines. We have Marty calling in from San Jose. So Marty, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hey, how's it going? I just wanted to say, just real quick, I don't disagree with what this lady is saying, but as a man, I have two 7-month-old twins at home, and my wife, she is the best at taking care of them. I can't even describe. I feel like I'm inadequate in dealing with them and seeing her. She has this patience, and I think that, yeah, it's nice if a woman can go to work, but, there's something about it where women just have this natural tendency to be mothers, and
I can't. I'm not great at it, man. I mean, I'm a great dad. I'm there every night, but damn. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Marty, I appreciate you sharing your experience and congratulations on the twins. Laura, what is your response to Marty's comment here?
Well, first of all, I don't in any way intend to pass judgment on women who choose to stay home and take care of their children. First of all, that is labor. The fact that they don't get paid for it does not change the fact that it's incredibly hard work. And I agree that it takes a really specific skill set. So my purpose in writing this was not to sort of set up these opposing camps and say one way of doing things is better than another. I think that women in an ideal world would be free to choose whatever they wanted to do, whether it was to stay home or to go to work. The truth of the matter is, though, that most women don't have a choice. They need to be able to support their children. That includes me. I'm now a single parent. And also that for many women, not all, but many, doing purposeful work is rewarding. It is joyful. It is remunerative. And it really gives their life a shape and a purpose. And I wanted to honor those women.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marty, I appreciate you calling in and sharing your experience. And I think, Laura, your point is very well taken that this is really about giving people the freedom to do what they want, whether that's being a great mother in the home or prioritizing their career, that it really shouldn't be gendered. But I wanted to talk about something you describe in the book, which is sort of the flip side to the idealized caregiver, which is the mother in the workplace who never lets the complications from home interfere with her work life, but instead smiles and soldiers on. Maybe that celebrity account you were talking about of celebrities who seem to be doing it so well. But can you talk about the importance of women sharing their struggles and not just striving to try to make it all look so easy? And you, in the book, you talk about the story of one young mother, Amanda Renteria, who maybe fits that description. But if you want to tell her story or just in general, what the importance of not making it look so easy might be.
Yes. And Ethan, I just appreciate how deeply and thoroughly you read the book. I think it is important to convey to other people that you're working with, particularly the younger women coming up after you, that this is not this flawless tap dance that Ginger Rogers would do, where there are just no mistakes and it looks perfect. And then in fact, what's going on behind the scenes, it's like a duck and you know, what's going on under the surface is furious paddling. With Amanda, she was this incredibly accomplished woman who became a power player on Capitol Hill. At the same time, when she was pregnant, she felt like she couldn't show that she had any vulnerabilities. She had a miscarriage in the bathroom. And it was really only after she had her second child and it was younger staff members saying to her, essentially, you make this look too easy, that she realized she kind of had an affirmative obligation to show them how difficult it actually was. And that's something that I really took to heart. And I feel like in my own life as a law professor with my students, I don't hide the fact that at times it can be incredibly challenging. And I let them to some degree see those moments because I want them to understand that it's possible to succeed and not have everything be airbrushed and perfect all the time.
Mm-hmm. So I guess don't show the fake Zoom background, show the mess in the house and be upfront about the mess that happens when you're trying to juggle two really difficult tasks of having a career and children at the same time. I wanted to ask about a finding that you came across a lot in your conversations with women that you documented in the book. And this is that many of these women shared a reflexive rejection of the word ambition and that label and a deep-seated reluctance to acknowledge that ambition, in fact, did fuel their drive to succeed. So why do you think even incredibly successful women are so reluctant to acknowledge their ambition?
It's really fascinating, isn't it? Because when you look up ambition in the dictionary, it really just means wanting to succeed and wanting to achieve. It's very simple. And yet I think when it's applied to women, they think of it as self-aggrandizing. They think of it as arrogant. They think of it as putting themselves forward in a way that's somehow unflattering or unfeminine or too much. And I think that that is so ingrained, this idea that we need to be at all times self-effacing and modest, that it's very, very hard to just say, I got this job because I deserve it. I got this job because I wanted it and I worked very hard and because I'm the best qualified person. When you ask most women, how did you get where you are? A lot of times what you'll hear from them is, I was just in the right place at the right time, or I got very lucky, or I'm just humbled and honored to be here. You can be humbled and honored and also know that you're deeply deserving and own that. It's harder for women to do that than it is for men.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you make the point in the book that men don't tend to use those words as much as women in describing their success. So there definitely is something gendered going on there. And I think it was an interesting point that you made in the book. I want to let listeners know that if you're just tuning in, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind. And tonight I'm speaking with law professor, author, and mother of two, Laura Bazelon, about the challenges and benefits of being a working mother. You can join the conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We'd love to hear from you if you are a working mother or the child of a working mother or the spouse of a working mother. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this conversation. You can also email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. So, Laura, many working mothers try to draw rigid boundaries between their work life and their home life. And you argue in the book that that's actually untenable. And you saw firsthand the benefits of not letting that happen, especially during the pandemic, when your children watched you work to exonerate an individual in New Orleans, Utico Briley Jr., who was convicted of armed robbery. And can you tell us about how that sort of shaped up and how that affected your children and the value of incorporating kids into your work world as a parent?
Yes. So my students and I at the law clinic at USF started representing Utico in 2019. And in 2020, the prison in Louisiana started allowing Zoom visits. That was at the same time that my kids, of course, were forced to quarantine and homeschool. And we live in a kind of small apartment. I was working in the kitchen. They were coming in and out all the time. And so when my students and I were meeting with Utico on Zoom, my kids would appear in the frame as they were going to the refrigerator and opening the cabinet, looking for snacks. And they basically developed a relationship with him. He's a fairly young man. He just turned 28. And they bonded over things like sports. He would tease them. They really became almost friends. And I think they provided a lifeline for him of normalcy and something pure. And they were really interested in his case and what had happened to cause him to be there, even though he hadn't done anything wrong. And you know, it really turned into this very powerful relationship on both sides that was incredibly affirming during this extremely dark time when my kids weren't really interacting with very much of anyone. Ultimately, when I was able to go to Louisiana, still during the pandemic, to exonerate him, my children watched on Zoom. And it was one of the most powerful experiences of my life. And a couple of months later, I brought them back and we celebrated his birthday with him. And I think what that really shows is that trying to cabin things off, It's difficult. And I'm not really sure it's for the best, because my kids learned all these lessons about the triumph of the human spirit, about the triumph of good over racism, of hard work and diligence, and of just a human connection with someone who was very different from them, but still very much wanting a source of light and hope. And so for me, that experience really drove home how important it is to sometimes link up those two different areas of your life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, and I think for the children, they can understand better if a parent has to miss a milestone event, if they understand the value of the work outside of the home that parent is doing. So we have a comment from a listener who says, I intentionally put off having kids until I was well established in my career. I feel very lucky that my company has been flexible about taking some time off to care for them when I need to. I think it helped that I was upfront about that when I started with my current job. I'm wondering, Laura, if you have a reaction to that and thoughts about how, you know, women in particular should be managing their career and relationships with motherhood.
I love that your listener is so proactive about advocating for herself and what she needs. I really wish I had done that. When I had my second child, I had a job where I was told that if I didn't come back after 12 weeks of unpaid leave, I would be fired. And I came back, even though I wasn't really ready to, and that's not what I wanted. And I wish at the time I'd had the presence of mind to say, I'm not going to do that. I don't think they actually would have fired me. Sometimes I think it's really a failure to advocate for ourselves. It's so hard for women to advocate for ourselves. We're great at advocating for other people, our clients, our friends, our children. And I love that your listener was really able to be clear up front and say, this is what I want, this is what I need, and this is what I deserve. And so I think it's exactly that attitude and spirit that we need moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And one of the difficult subjects that you talk in the book and are very frank about is your own divorce, but how you felt that that ultimately improved your situation. And you wrote how it basically, you described it as a reformation of the family that brought some unexpected benefits. And you, of course, acknowledge that the jury is still out on how it might affect your children. But what did you find or did you seek out research on how divorce affects children? Because it's a tough thing to balance being sort of squelched in a relationship, but divorce, by all the studies that I've read, can have a very negative impact on children. So how do you sort of balance those two risks for a working mother in a difficult relationship versus the impacts that leaving that relationship might have on the children?
This is really important. I think there are a couple of things to think about here. The first one is, if staying in the relationship is going to be so unhealthy that you're going to be deeply unhappy and your children are going to know it, then they're going to grow up in a very inhospitable environment. And I think sometimes people tell themselves, we stayed together for the children, and they tell themselves a story where the children believe that they were happily married and it was a functional relationship when it wasn't. And the truth is that 9 times out of 10, the children know the truth, that it was not a happy relationship at all. And so the question then becomes, if you can't stay in the relationship because it is deeply unhappy, how do you navigate the post-divorce landscape? And I don't even pretend to speak for everyone, but in my family, we prioritize our children. We prioritize their health, their well-being. We do everything we can to collaborate and cooperate and really leave our differences for the conversations where they're not there, and to intentionally spend time together as a family. So our kids always know that they are the most important thing. Mm-hmm. I don't advocate for divorce. I don't think it's ideal. I do think in our particular situation, I hope, and yes, mm-hmm. the jury is out, but I hope my children know that we did this really for them and that they are always the most important thing to us.
Mm-hmm. Well, jury is still out is an appropriate expression for an accomplished litigator and professor. That's unfortunately all the time that we have today. But I want to thank you so much for joining us, Laura Bazelon, professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law and author of the new book, Ambitious Like a Mother, Why Prioritizing Your Career is Good for Your Kids. Comes out tomorrow. Go out and get your copy. Thank you so much for joining us, Laura.
Thank you so much for having me. I love talking to you.
Great. Well, we love having you on the show and hope we can have you back on soon. And coming up after the break, we'll hear co-host Grace Wan's interview with Jay Dondi of the San Francisco Briones Society about that organization's new vision for the Republican Party in San Francisco. Stay with us.
San Francisco is known as a bastion of liberal politics, where the fractious political spectrum ranges from the passionate center-left all the way to the passionate far-left. But the San Francisco Republican Party does exist, and there are conservatives in the city. I'm pleased to be joined by one of them, Jay Dondi. He's the founder of the center-right San Francisco Briones Society, and he's here to share with us his priorities for the city and what it feels like to be a Republican in San Francisco. Welcome to State of the Bay, Jay Dondi.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit about the Briones Society.
The idea behind the Briones Society is that there is a large, unheard, and underserved constituency of voters in San Francisco that's primarily motivated by good schools, clean streets, safe neighborhoods. And they feel that the Democratic Party is too far to the left for them and is more kind of steeped in a performative progressivism. But at the same time, they look at the Republican Party, and they're pretty uncomfortable by what they see there as well. And they think that the GOP has moved too far to the right. And so the Briones Society is an attempt to tell those voters two things. First off, the picture that you might have of the Republican Party is not entirely accurate. In fact, the majority of Republicans in the city, I would say, are just regular everyday people who are focused on the same kitchen table concerns that you have. But the second thing we say is, we get it. There are some troubling elements in the GOP, especially at the national level, and you may not feel comfortable becoming a Republican right away, but maybe you'll be more comfortable coming to a Briones Society event more clearly identified with a moderate or centrist wing of the party.
And what are your priorities for San Francisco? What do you want to see?
So what we're trying to do, at least in the short term, is really to advocate for common sense, urgent solutions to the problems that we have here. And for us, that looks like drafting legislation and then shopping it around to elected officials to adopt or putting it directly on the ballot for voters to approve. And specifically, we're looking at two issues right now, one of which is government transparency, and the other one is public safety. And both of those are, I think, top of mind for voters in the city at the moment.
What are your specific concerns about public safety?
Yeah, so what we'd like to see is an increase in the number of police officers on the street. And the reason is because study after study shows that if you have more police, you'll have less crime. And you don't have to take it from me. You can take it from Jennifer Doliak at Texas A&M, who's probably the preeminent researcher in America on this topic. And this is a direct quote from her. There's a strong consensus in the literature that hiring more police reduces crime. And unfortunately, you don't hear an acknowledgement of that reality on the left. Instead, you hear calls to defund the police. But here's the really important thing. It's not just more police, less crime. It's more police, fewer prisons, less crime. Because if you're concerned about mass incarceration, and I think we all should be, whether we're on the left or the right, there's extensive evidence that shows the best way to keep people from going to prison is to deter them from committing crimes in the first place. And compared to other Western countries, we have far fewer sworn officers per capita in the United States. And San Francisco is a particularly egregious example of this problem. We've been operating at a deficit of almost 400 officers for the past few years, and we're about to lose a few hundred more this summer due to retirements and people just leaving the force due to the hostile environment for policing in the city.
Well, there is a reason why people are skeptical of more police being the solution to the problem. What do you say to a person who feels that the police actually are more threatening to them and actually aren't policing them for their safety?
I think those are absolutely legitimate concerns, and I don't have any intention of dismissing them whatsoever. I think what I would say, though, is that the more police that we have on the street, and the more capable they are of pursuing forms of policing that are less threatening, less militarized, and more community-oriented, rather than running from call to call to call and responding to emergency situation, start taking the time to develop relationships within the community and get to know the people that they're supposed to be protecting and serving.
You're talking about reviving the presence of the GOP in the city of San Francisco, and I know you want to make a distinction between the national GOP, but even the state GOP is a little bit out of sync with what might be viewed as the prevailing opinion in San Francisco. For example, the official party platform of the California Republican Party says that it defines marriage as a union between one man and one woman. How do you make that distinction of the Briona Society being a GOP club per se, but not aligning itself with platforms of the state party?
Yeah, and I think this is a really important question, because the reality is that there are a lot of folks in San Francisco who may agree with us on issues that relate specifically to public safety and clean streets, again, and good governance, but they're not even willing to have a conversation about conservative solutions to the city's problems until you proclaim these shibboleths, right? And one of those shibboleths is, what do you think about what's happening at the national level, at the state level? So we don't have any problem advocating for more centrist and more liberal policies, especially socially liberal policies. We think that that's actually more representative of Republicans in San Francisco than what might be in the state GOP platform. But at the same time, that's fine. You know, we want to have a diverse party, and the San Francisco Republican Party shouldn't look like the Fresno Republican Party, which shouldn't look like the Dallas Republican Party, which shouldn't look like the Miami Republican Party, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's space for your version of the Republican Party in the Republican Party?
Well, I certainly hope so. And I think that it's important for there to be two strong, vibrant parties, especially in the city of San Francisco, contesting the center of the political spectrum and engaged in a battle of ideas rather than rhetoric, because we have seen what it looks like for the past 40 years to have one party rule in the city And I don't even think the Democrats are happy with it because they don't have a strong bulwark to check the excesses of their own party.
Well, it might seem odd to ask, but why are you committed to the Republican Party? Why not just work within the center left since you're so firmly in the political center?
Yeah, so I personally believe in certain bedrock Republican principles, among them that accountability and freedom are the twin pillars of a healthy society. And in San Francisco, and especially on the left, it does seem that we've developed this sort of allergy to the notion of accountability, and it's viewed as antithetical to being compassionate. And I actually think that the opposite is true. I think that if you show me a person who's never been held accountable for their actions or an organization that never holds any of its members accountable, I'll show you a group of dysfunctional, unhappy people who've been denied the opportunity for personal growth. And I also think that government, while it's necessary, I'm certainly not the type of Republican that doesn't think government should exist at all. I think it should do a few big things well rather than a lot of small things poorly, which is kind of what it's doing now. And it's important to be realistic about the limits of what government can do and not use it as a vehicle to solve every problem in society. And I think that that's a distinctly conservative Republican view and not well represented in the Democratic Party.
So going forward, are there any elected officials who are allies with you all?
I think that we have a really great crop of Republicans running for office in the city in June. We have John Dennis running for U.S. House of Representatives. We have Gus Mottemal running for U.S. House of Representatives. Bill Shireman is running for Assembly District 17. And Karsten Vita is running against Phil Ting in Assembly District 19. And no candidate is perfect, but I am happy to stack up the achievements and competence and character of any of those folks against their Democratic opponents. I think we truly have an inspiring and uniquely qualified crop of Republican candidates this year.
And is that what your club is trying to do, create a pipeline for more candidates or support candidates to run under a GOP banner?
Well, that's part of what we're trying to do. But I think what we really want to do, again, in the long term, is ensure that there is a credible and competitive alternative to the Democratic Party in the city of San Francisco in the form of a strong and vibrant Republican Party. And, you know, that's going to take a lot of work. But one thing that I will say is that if you're a moderate in the city, if you're a centrist in the city, and you feel disenfranchised by the city's politics, you're a best bet for affecting the type of change that you may want to see is not in the Democratic Party. It's in the Republican Party. And I think that the reason for that is because the Democratic Party has been dominated more or less for the last few years and will continue to be dominated in the future, I think, by the progressive wing of that movement. And they have no reason to change because they're winning 100% of the elections at the moment.
Well, I mean, I would say that there certainly is a progressive wing of the Democratic Party in San Francisco, but there is the District 2 is relatively moderate, almost centered. I would say Catherine Stefani is known to be a moderate on issues.
Absolutely. That's true. And I think we have maybe 1.5 moderates on the Board of Supervisors. I'll let you guess who may be the half, and it may actually change from day to day. But nonetheless, that's more than a supermajority. We're talking about 9 or 10 supervisors on any given day that actually would blanch at being called moderate and would expressly identify themselves as being progressive.
Somebody wants to learn more. How can they learn more about your organization, Jay?
Yeah, they can sign up for our newsletter at our website, brionessociety.org, or they can follow us on Twitter at Briona Society.
Well, Jay Dondi of the San Francisco Briona Society, thanks so much for being on State of the Bay.
Thank you.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. I want to thank all of our guests and listeners for being part of the conversation. For more information on this and other shows, you can visit our State of the Bay page on kalw.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us at any time at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Make sure to join us next week when I'll be sitting down with local author Vanessa Waugh to discuss her new book, Forbidden City. Tonight's show is produced by Chris Nooney and Wendy Holcomb. It was engineered by David Kwan, and Joanne Marr was our board operator. Good night, and thanks so much for listening.